by finishing up what goes on in the nucleus that we didn't get to last time. And we talked about the structure of the nucleus, about nuclear pores and the role of laminin in supporting the nuclear envelope. And today I want to talk about the nucleolus. You may remember that in the nucleus, which I will just draw this way for now, there is an area which stains very darkly during interphase and is not visible during division and has no membrane surrounding it. And that's the nucleolus. Now, we've already indicated that this is an area for the assembly of ribosomal subunits. And I want to consider what that means. What has to go on? So, it turns out that to make a cytoplasmic ribosome requires a great deal of traffic in and out of the nucleus through the pores. And to see how that works, let's look at the DNA and consider that there's a region that codes for ribosomal RNA. So there are genes for ribosomal RNA just as there are genes for protein. And so this is usually called the ribosomal DNA, that which codes for the ribosomal, the big ribosomal RNA. Now, this is all going on inside the nucleus. I'll put a couple of pores in, I guess. Now, ribosomal RNA by itself does not exit the nucleus. So you have to make the large and small ribosomal RNAs into their respective subunits first, and then the subunit is going to exit the nucleus. So the ribosomal RNA has to get it together with the ribosomal protein to form subunits. There's going to be two kinds, big subunits, small subunits. And then they are going to exit through the nuclear pore into the cytoplasm. So where do the ribosomal proteins come from? Where are they made? Well, they're made in the cytoplasm. Most people think there are no functioning ribosomes and no protein synthesis in the nucleus at all. So the ribosomal proteins must have been made out here. But if we made ribosomal proteins, what did we need? We needed messenger RNA, because actually quite a lot, because there are a lot of ribosomal proteins. So we needed messenger RNA to exit the nucleus through these pores. It had to be translated using pre-existing ribosomes to make new ribosomal proteins. So the RNA had to go out, but now the ribosomal proteins have to go back in. Well, we forgot one thing. Where did the RNA come from? The messenger RNA. This is a protein like any other protein, so it has genes. It's not one protein, but many. So there are actually genes not just for ribosomal RNA, but for ribosomal protein. Now, they were transcribed in the nucleus, and then that messenger RNA was processed if necessary, and then moved out to the cytoplasm. So let's see what it takes. You have to make messenger RNA for the proteins, send it outside, translate it, move the proteins back in again, have the proteins assemble with the ribosomal RNA, get subunits, and ship the subunits out. And only now do you have useful subunits in the cytoplasm. And now two of those subunits, a small and a large, can come together on a message, form a working ribosome, and make protein. So you can see there's a lot of traffic here in and out. Now, there's one other thing about this in terms of terminology and looking. When you look in the microscope, you see the nucleolus during interphase, but you don't see it during mitosis or meiosis. What's happening is that this area where the nucleolus is. When you're making ribosomal subunits, this area is full of ribosomal RNA, ribosomal proteins, new subunits, all being assembled and on their way out. But during mitosis, you stop making RNA. So there's no more new message. Whatever message there is makes ribosomal proteins. So the proteins come in. There's no more new ribosomal RNA either. So all the ribosomal RNA and protein that you have form subunits and leaves. So during mitosis and meiosis, this area empties out and it disappears. So this is a sort of assembly spot for making ribosomal subunits. And when you're not making those subunits, they're all just sort of shipped out. You don't have any more parts. You don't have any more workers. And everything just empties out. So the nucleolus is only visible during interphase. But what about this section of the DNA? This is the section of the DNA where the nucleolus will form, because it's the part that encodes ribosomal RNA. And this part is going to be here all the time. But during mitosis, meiosis, it's not going to be doing anything. This is often called the NOR, or the nucleolar organizing region. And it's just the ribosomal DNA. Now, every genome has at least one of these. It may have many. They may all come together and make one nucleolus, or each one may make an individual nucleolus. Now, there's one more piece we have to say here. There actually, in any individual nucleolar organizing region, there isn't one copy of the genes for ribosomal DNA. There are many. So if you look at an NOR, there's one copy of the genes for ribosomal RNA, another one, another one, another one. So these are all ribosomal DNA. Now, why do you need multiple copies of this gene or genes? For most proteins, there's only one copy per genome of the respective gene. But you can still make a lot of that protein if you want to. Even though there's only one copy of the gene, how can you make a lot of protein fast? Well, remember the message. You take that one copy of the gene, you make many copies of the message, and you translate them all simultaneously. So you have multiple copies of the message all being read out at once, and each one, of course, has polyribosomes. So you can churn out a lot of protein. You have these amplifying devices. But if you want to make a ribosomal RNA, you just have one copy of the template per genome. And so if you want to make a lot of ribosomal RNA, you have to have, in a short time, you have to have many copies of the template so you can make many copies of our ribosomal RNA at once. So these are the cytoplasmic ribosomes. Are there any other ribosomes? Remember, if you have mitochondria or chloroplasts, there are ribosomes in there too. And those are assembled inside the organelle. The proteins are made in the cytoplasm, the RNA is made inside the organelle, and they're put together inside the organelle. Now, while we're talking about the nucleus, there are actually two other parts that I want to mention. We already talked about the lamins and the nuclear lamina and the perinuclear space and all that. But what else is in here? Well, one very important thing are the enzymes that you need to make RNA, RNA polymerase. Now, in bacteria, there's only one RNA polymerase. But in eukaryotes, there are three. So there's one in prokaryotes, three in eukaryotes. In some ways, everything in eukaryotes is very similar to what's in prokaryotes. After all, we're all evolutionarily related. But usually things in eukaryotes are more complicated. Same, but more difficult. Jacob of Jacob and Minot of Operons used to say, what is true of E. coli is true of the elephant. Well, on a basic level, yes. But on another level, the elephant has tricks that the bacterium doesn't do. Of course, there's some vice versa also. But things are more complicated in the cells of the elephant. So there are three polymerases, which are known as RNA polymerase 1, 2, with Roman numerals, and 3. Now, there's in your notes are the details of what they do. The brief answer is that the polymerase which makes the large ribosomal RNAs is RNA polymerase 1. The polymerase responsible for making almost all messenger RNA and therefore controlling protein production is Pol2. This is the one we're going to concentrate on because it's the regulation of this enzyme that determines what RNA you make, what messenger, and what proteins. And therefore, the regulation of this one is the most interesting. Now, the third one, which is called Pol3, is involved in making small RNAs, like transfer RNA, 5S ribosomal RNA, etc. And these differ in their location in the nucleus. They differ in what they make, of course, and they differ in their sensitivity to different drugs. And, of course, they transcribe different parts of the DNA. Now, which one is going to be found in the nucleolus? Well, what are you making in the nucleolus? Ribosomal RNA, you're going to have Pol1. Now, in the complications department, we should make one other statement, that in bacteria, if you want transcription, you need a DNA template and you need RNA polymerase. In eukaryotes, if you want transcription, not only do you need the appropriate polymerase and a DNA template, but you need a whole bunch of associated enzymes. And these are called transcription factors. Or TFs. They're called TF2 if they help, if they're required by RNA polymerase 2, TF1 if they're needed by RNA polymerase 1. But they're multiple, so RNA polymerase 2 needs a whole bunch of them. So there's TF2A, TF2B, TF2C. I don't know what they're up to by now, but there are a lot of them. And Dr. Heiklin will talk about these next time. I just want to say that these are usually divided into two categories, which are called basal or general and regulatory or tissue specific. And the difference is that these, the basal ones, are found in virtually all cells and are pretty much the same from cell to cell. But the regulatory ones are tissue specific. And in some ways, they're the most interesting because they're the ones that determine the special RNAs that each, and therefore proteins, that each specialized cell type makes. And Dr. Heiklin will talk more about it. Now, there is, besides all these proteins that you need for transcription, there's something else in the nucleus that we've been ignoring. Well, I drew it in my picture, actually. What good is RNA polymerase without DNA? Obviously, you have DNA in there. But by the eukaryotes are more complicated rule, it's a little bit different. In prokaryotes, you have plain old DNA. But in eukaryotes, the DNA is associated with a special set of proteins. And the protein DNA complex is called chromatin. Now, most of the proteins in chromatin, so we could separate it into the DNA and the proteins. Most of the proteins are a set of small basic proteins called histones. We'll talk more about them in a minute. And there are a few others which are quite important in regulation, but we'll focus on the histones. Now, I think we've drawn pictures before of what cells look like at mitosis and what they look like in interphase. In both of those cases and everything in between, DNA is in the form of chromatin. It's not loose. It's always associated with proteins. But the difference is how tightly the DNA protein complex is coiled and supercoiled and folded up. During mitosis, it's extremely tight. During interphase, most of it is relatively loose. Now, how do you analyze the state of chromatin? The first level, and that's really what I want to talk about next, is how you look at chromatin. So let me ask if there are any questions before I go on to chromatin. Yeah? Did I say that a nucleus can have more than one nucleolus? Yes. It depends on the species. In some species, all the NORs come together and you make one big fat nucleolus. And in some cells, they're separate. And then you have multiple NORs and each forms its own small nucleolus. Okay. So the first issue we want to talk about with chromatin is what do you see if you look in the light microscope? And for this, you want to look at the top of handout 8A. And the question is, where did I put my copy? Here it is. Okay. Okay, so what we have here are the division of chromatin into two basic states. One way to look at it is that during division, all the DNA is very tightly wound up. Looks very tight and condensed and stains heavily. And DNA that stains heavily is called heterochromatin. And this is relatively tight. So you could say that in mitosis or meiosis, it's all heterochromatin. Everything is very tight. But during interphase, most of the chromatin loosens up a bit and forms what's called euchromatin, which is relatively unfolded and loose, but still associated with proteins, histones in particular. But a small amount of the DNA or chromatin remains very tight or heterochromatic. So that's why we have these two main categories. Heterochromatin, tightly condensed, easily stained, visible, and euchromatin, which in fact, when you look at it in the microscope, looks sort of like this. You can't see anything in particular. So this is relatively tight and relatively loose. Now, heterochromatin itself is subdivided into two categories, as you can see on the handout in your table, which are called constitutive and facultative. Now, if you have a piece of the chromatin or the DNA that is always remains tight in every cell during interphase, that's called constitutive heterochromatin. Doesn't matter what cell you look in, that area is going to be tight and heterochromatic. And the examples of that DNA, which is never transcribed, it serves more of a structural function. The examples of this are at the ends of chromosomes, at telomeres, at centromeres, which are the spot in the middle of the, somewhere along the chromatid, which allows sister chromatids to stick together and spindle fibers to stick to the chromosome. So these areas remain tight all the time, and they are never transcribed. Now, what is also interesting is that if you look at the DNA in here, the DNA itself has a very repetitive structure. It doesn't seem to contain information, which fits with its function, and usually it has a repeated sequence, like AGGCT, AGGCT, AGGCT. I made that one up. But whatever it is, it usually has repeating DNA. Now, this DNA is a sort of structural component of the chromosome. What about facultative heterochromatin? Now, that refers to areas of chromatin that if you look in one cell can be heterochromatic, but if you look in other cells or at other times, it's not heterochromatic. It's euchromatic or stretched out. And this is stuff that is sometimes heterochromatic as opposed to areas that are always. Now, the most famous example of facultative heterochromatin is the inactive X, or the X that forms a bar body. If you look at the DNA, which is in the inactive X, in another cell, that DNA may be euchromatic, and the other X may be heterochromatic. So this isn't always the same in every cell. Now, heterochromatin is generally genetically inactive. It is not transcribed. So facultative heterochromatin isn't transcribed either. So the inactive X, whichever one is inactive, is not transcribed. But in another cell, that X may be euchromatic, it may be transcribed, and the other X may be heterochromatic. So facultative heterochromatin is usually capable of coding. It's not structural, but it is sometimes very tight and not used. Now that's heterochromatin, but what's with euchromatin? There's a temptation to divide chromatin into genetically active euchromatin and genetically inactive heterochromatin. That isn't quite right. All heterochromatin is genetically inactive, but not all euchromatin is genetically active. In order to be genetically active, that is to be transcribed and code for anything, in order to be active, you have to be euchromatic. But this is a necessary but not sufficient condition. So not all euchromatin is in fact genetically active. Now you've noticed in your handout, we've divided it into three categories with the technical names of loose, looser, and loosest. Now this is to some extent arbitrary. All euchromatin is looser than heterochromatin, but among euchromatin, there's a continuum from looser to even more so. Now, for convenience, we often divide it into these three categories, but it's probably really a continuum. And the argument is that in general, the loose stuff which for you chromatin is the tightest, is genetically inactive. The middle category is being transcribed is genetically active, and the loosest corresponds to regulatory regions. So we'll talk a little bit more about that as we go. So euchromatin is looser than hetero, capable of transcription, but not necessarily being transcribed right now. Now, the catch is that all of these look about the same in the light microscope. So just from looking, you have no way of telling which genes are really on and which genes are just lying around and are off during interphase. And I just want to repeat one more time that during interphase, almost all the DNA is euchromatic, but only some of it is transcribed. So that's what you learn from looking in the light microscope. But what do you learn from looking further, looking, say, in the electron microscope? Now, if you've already printed out the notes, the section under 3A is missing some details. In my cut and paste operation, I lost some. And I will put a link into the missing stuff later. The basic points are here. What happens if you look in the electron microscope at chromatin? Well, if you take normal chromatin under physiological conditions and you spread it out on a grid and you look at it in the electron microscope, looks like this. Useless. But if you take the chromatin and you put it in a low salt solution with a low salt content, it unravels even more. And what you see is something that looks like this. This is usually called the beads on a string state. And remember, this is not naked DNA. This is DNA with histones. Now I'm going to talk a little bit about the DNA first and then more about the histones. The question, of course, is where are the histones? Which part is DNA? Which part is histones? How is it wrapped up, etc.? Now, a lot of what we know about the structure of chromatin is indirect. It comes from treating chromatin with various conditions like low salt and seeing what happens. And one of the standard ways of getting at chromatin is to treat it with some form of nuclease. That is an enzyme that degrades DNA. Now, if you treat plain old DNA with nuclease, what do you think happens? Chop, 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 degrade it into pieces. But if you treat chromatin, some of the DNA is more tightly wrapped and protected than others. And using these enzymes, one can often distinguish different states of the DNA. So we're actually going to talk about two different nucleases today. We're going to talk about micrococcal nuclease, which comes from the bacterium Micrococcus. And we're going to talk about DNase 1. Which I think is a digestive enzyme. Neither of these enzymes is sequence specific. They're not like restriction enzymes. Restriction enzymes cut every time a certain sequence appears. These don't care about sequence. They care about the 3D shape of the DNA and its association with proteins. They tend to degrade what's sticking out more than what isn't. But they differ in their specificity, as we'll explain. Now, is the mic working properly? Yeah, okay. Sounds a little less lighter to me. Okay. So, the next step was to take chromatin and treat it with micrococcal nuclease. Now remember, you're not treating DNA. You're treating the DNA protein complex. So you start with chromatin and you treat it with DNase. And then you take off the protein. have the DNA, and you want to see, what does the DNA look like? Was it completely protected? Was it chewed up? What happened? Now, if you take chromatin and you treat it with a low amount of micrococcal nuclease, and then you extract the DNA, so remember, you treated chromatin, not DNA, but then you peeled off the protein and looked at the DNA. And how do you examine DNA? Do you want to see how big the pieces are? How would you find out? You would do an electrophoretic gel. So if you run this DNA on a gel, you get a very famous pattern, which is called a ladder, that looks like this. The DNA is, you started with the sample in here, and you ran it this way. Now, what you get then are a series of pieces that are all multiples of 200. So this is 200 base pairs, 400, 600, 800, 1,000, etc. Now, what would give you a pattern like that? We realize that there's something that repeats every 200. It turns out that microtocal nuclease cuts preferentially at one point in between the beads. There's something about this part here that it sticks out more. So it might be better to draw the DNA like this if you add a little bit of micrococcal nuclease. The only points that get cut are these that stick out. So in one molecule you cut here and here. That gives you a piece 200 base pairs long. But in another molecule, you might cut here and there. Then you get a piece 400 base pairs long. You don't cut at every single one of these. You cut at some of them. And so some pieces are 200, some pieces are 4, some pieces are 600. So there's clearly a repeating unit here, and the repeating unit is usually called a nucleosome. Now, on the other hand, what if you use a lot of micrococcal nuclease? It turns out this is what happens if you use a little. If you treat the chromatin with a lot of micrococcal nuclease, take off the protein and look at the DNA that's left, this is what you get. You get only one band at 145 base pairs. What has happened here is a little bit of micrococcal nuclease cuts at this very exposed point or not at all. But a lot of micrococcal nuclease cuts all the way in between the beads. So what's left? Whatever DNA was associated with the bead is unscathed, and it's apparently 145 base pairs long. So one complete repeating unit is 200 base pairs. This so-called core nucleosome contains 145 approximately base pairs. And that means that the rest of it, or about 55 base pairs, are in what's called a linker. That's what you find between cores. So what this says is that micrococcal nuclease preferentially cuts exposed DNA, but it doesn't cut DNA associated with nucleosomes. And from this we get the idea that you have these beads connected with linkers. There's one especially exposed point in the linker, and the linker is more exposed than the DNA in the beads. So what's in the bead? We've been talking about the DNA part. What about the protein part? We've said the DNA is associated with histones. The proteins in here, in the beads, are histones. So let's look at them. There are actually five major kinds of histone. So where is the eraser? And these are all small, basic proteins. When you take chromatin apart, you get DNA, you get histones, as we said before, and you get a few other proteins, which we're ignoring. Now, the histones can be subdivided into what's in the core, inside or on that little bead, and what is outside the core, associated more or less with the linker. And this is the one that's called H1, histone 1. And the core has what is called H2A, H2B, H3, and H4. And the core turns out to consist of two molecules each of H2A, H2B, H3, and H4. So that's why it's called an octamer, because it has two each for a total of eight molecules of histone, or an octamer. Now, histones are very evolutionarily conserved. If you compare human histone, say, and cow histone, it's very, very similar. H4 is, in fact, the most evolutionarily conserved protein known. And the argument is that if you this protein does such an essential function, because it's involved in regulation of DNA structure, of transcription, of replication of the works, that you can't change it very much without messing everything up. So this protein is about 102 amino acids long. And if you compare H4 from peas and H4 from cows, which have been evolving separately for millions of years, two of the 102 amino acids are the same, are different, and 100 are the same. So between peas and cows, 100 out of 102 amino acids are exactly the same. So per 200 base pairs of DNA, we have one molecule of H1 and two molecules each of H2A, H2B, H3, and H4. So the question is, how is it all put together? Now we know that when you put the DNA together with the four core histones, this DNA is protected from nuclease. So, what would you think? Is the protein on the outside of the DNA, or the DNA on the outside of the protein? No cheating if you read ahead. You would think, since the DNA is protected, that the protein would be on the outside. But the big surprise is the protein's on the inside. So the picture of that is actually on 8B of what a nucleosome looks like on the bottom. No, I mean A. It's on both of them, but A is better. So A shows you a picture, but maybe it's a little better if we do it a little more dynamically. So you've seen these beads before. They've been amino acids. They've been nucleotides. Today they are core histones. So this is meant to be an octamer. Two molecules each of 2A, 2B, 3, and 4. And this is the DNA. Double-stranded, of course. So it turns out that the DNA is wrapped twice around each octamer. And then there's that linker space. And then it's wrapped twice around the next octamer. I think I got it right. And then it's wrapped twice around the next one, and so on. So this is the basic beads on a string structure. Now, what your little picture shows you is what one of these looks like. It shows you one octamer with the DNA on it. Now, appropriately for the time of year, you notice that the octamer is drawn more or less as a heart. So the core nucleosomes look sort of like this. And then the DNA is wrapped around it twice. So in their picture, the DNA comes from here, and then it goes behind, and then it does it again, and then it comes out. So this is the double-stranded DNA, and this is the core. And the H1, as shown in this picture, is somewhere out here. This is the H1. Now, in living cells, this DNA is wrapped around the cores, but then the nucleosome beads on a string structure is folded upon itself and itself again many times. The DNA in your cells is extremely long. It's about a meter. But as you all know, I hope from the last exam, your cells are measured in microns. And so that DNA, even though it's broken into chromosomes, is still very large. And the DNA of each chromosome is assembled first into nucleosomes and then folded further. And when it's transcribed, it may be stretched out to the nucleosome stage. But the rest of the time, it's probably tighter. So in a minute, we're going to look how you take this beads on a string structure and make it into tighter, shorter structures. But first, it's worth mentioning a little bit more about what this looks like. So if you turn your page over, on the right are pictures which come from X-ray crystallography of nucleosomes. And online are color pictures of this, which are much nicer. And the picture on the top actually shows you looking from this side. I think actually it's upside down, but it looks like this. You're looking from this side or this angle. The picture on the bottom is what it looks like if you look from the end. So in terms of our model, we're saying that the top picture, you're really looking this way, and you're seeing the two wraps of DNA. And in the other picture, you're looking down the middle. So you see the DNA around the protein. And one of the things that's important to notice is that the proteins are mostly compacted tightly in the middle, but they have short sections that stick out, which are called tails, or histone tails. These are not necessarily the tail end of the protein. They can be the amino or the carboxyl end. It turns out that interactions of these tails with each other and with other proteins are very important in the state of chromatin and how it's folded. Now, before we leave, why does doing this protect the DNA? After all, DNA is on the outside. The argument is that micrococcal nuclease and enzymes like it have to get on both sides of the DNA to catalyze breakage. And they just can't get under the DNA if it's so tightly wrapped. Whatever the reason, having the DNA tightly wrapped around these spools does seem to protect it in ways that are not totally obvious. So the next thing we want to ask is, what we're looking at, beads on a string, is a very loose form of chromatin. How do you get it tighter and tighter and tighter all the way up to the state it is in mitosis when it's extremely condensed and short? And so the picture on the left of 8B is a very famous picture. And there are similar pictures in your books and on the web, which illustrate how you pack the nucleosomes up. and how you can make the fiber shorter and shorter. So let's look at this for a minute. The idea is that you start with plain old DNA, and we know how long that is. Then you wrap that DNA around nucleosome cores to make a beads on a string structure, which, as we've said, looks something like this, as shown in your picture. Now, you notice those numbers on the left. Those numbers on the left are the diameter across. And in the table below, in addition, they have what is called compaction relative to previous, or the packing ratio. So one way to follow what's happening is to say, how wide is the fiber? This fiber, you notice, is only 2 nanometers across. Once you make nucleosomes, it's 10 to 11, and so on. And then if you fold these up on each other, you make something which is 30 nanometers across. Exactly how you fold these into this so-called 30-nanometer fiber or solenoid is not clear. Whether these are twisted around each other, whether they go back and forth, it's not entirely clear how it is. But probably you have a spiral braid, as it says on this sheet. Now, each time you do this, it gets thicker, and it also gets shorter. So if you look at the numbers, that's what's meant by compaction relative to previous. So if this is the basic length, this is 1/7. It's compacted 7 times, or it's 1/7 the length of the original. And this one is compacted, so this is 7x is the compaction, but 1/7 is the packing ratio. And there's a little table of this in your notes. You don't have to worry about getting it down. And this one is condensed or compacted another 6-fold, which means it's 1/42 of the length of the original. So the point is that as you keep folding it up, the fiber gets thicker and shorter. Until when you get to a mitotic chromosome, it's very big. It's so big you can see it in the light microscope, but it's quite short. It's very wide, but relatively short. So if you look at your handout, you see the various stages. That you start with plain DNA. Now, we think that in living cells, it never looks like this. It's always associated with some protein. Even if there are no nucleosomes, it's associated with some other protein. So we don't think we actually ever have this inside a living cell. But we do have the beads on a string structure, and then those are folded into a 30-nanometer fiber. And then these are thought to be looped and attached to some sort of matrix, probably protein. Now, it's thought, although it's not completely clear, that maybe these loops are units of transcription. So that if you want to transcribe something in this loop, you would pull this loop out to the beads on a string stage and leave all the other loops. So that each loop can be pulled out independently is the advantage of this structure. Now, what we're talking about here is all U chromatin. But once it gets much tighter than this, we're edging into heterochromatin. And you notice that this one is 700 nanometers across. And now, that's the next one. This one's only 300. And now we're going to take this and fold it. But there are really loops all along here. And that's 700 across. And then you fold it up in even more to make the chromatid of a mitotic chromosome. And by the time you get finished, your final chromatid, when you get done, is something like 1/20,000, something on that order of magnitude, the length of the original DNA. So that chromosomes heterochromatic in metaphase are extremely compacted. Now, we mentioned that the tails, the state of the tails, has something to do with the levels of packing. So does this histone H1. To get to this stage of beads on a string, you don't need any H1. But to fold the beads on a string up further, you have to have H1. Without H1, you can't fold it up anymore. The tightness or looseness of the folding and the general 3D shape is affected by the state of these tails. Remember, these are peptides. They have amino acids with side chains. And those side chains can be modified by the addition of phosphates, acetates, methyls, etc. Now, I only want to talk about one case because it relates to something we talked about before. You may remember that we said that when a cell goes from G2 to M, to mitosis, you have to take the nuclear membrane apart and you have to push it out of pieces out of the way so that you have room for the spindle and to move the chromosomes. And then at the end, when the cell goes from M to G back to G1 again, you have to reverse it. Now, we said earlier that when you go from G2 to M, you actually activate kinases. So they add phosphates to, among other things, the lamins, which allows them to disassemble, allows the nuclear membrane to come apart into vesicles so it can all be moved aside. But at the end of mitosis, when you, after anaphase, you get to telophase, you have to start putting back the nuclear membrane and the nuclear lamina. So to do that, you have to take the phosphates off. So starting around anaphase, you stop, the kinases are no longer active, but the phosphatases are active. So you put phosphates on protein to get to through mitosis, and you take phosphates off protein to get them back to their interphase state. It turns out that these kinases and phosphatases affect many proteins, and some of the proteins they affect are histones. They phosphorylate and dephosphorylated respectively, that is, kinases and phosphatases, histone tails. So I have a question for you. You have an active kinase that phosphorylates histones. Is that going to make them tighter or looser? Is that going to make the overall chromatin tighter or looser? I hear a rumor of tighter. Is there any reason you might think it would be looser? Histones stick to DNA, right? Histones are basic positive. DNA is negative. You think if you put more negatives on the histones, you would pry it apart, but you don't. In fact, as you guessed, you have to compact chromatin to get through mitosis. So phosphorylation must allow you to pack the chromatin tighter. And the argument for this is that when you pack chromatin into heterochromatin, what's important is the interaction of the tails and with other proteins. So it's not the DNA protein interaction that is being changed by modifying the tail. It's the protein protein interaction that's being modified. And adding phosphate groups allows the nucleosomes to pack tighter, allows you to get to heterochromatin. And then when you take those phosphates off with a phosphatase, then the chromatin can loosen up because in interphase, you have to go to the euchromatin stage. Now, I have been applying that the looser chromatin is transcribed, euchromatin, and the tighter euchromatin is not. And I want to explain how you get at finding out if there is a correlation. As we've written here, is there a correlation between the state of folding of euchromatin and its genetic activity or transcription? But before I do that, let me ask if there are questions about this stuff so far. Yeah? Are histones replaced ever? Yes. All of the proteins in the cell gradually wear out and are replaced. Yeah?
If telomeres are not transcribed, why is it such a big deal that they get degraded over time?
If telomeres are not transcribed, who cares if they get degraded? Well, the telomeres are sort of like caps on the ends. They serve two functions. One is to keep things from sticking to ends from sticking to each other. And the other is that they are in a non-coding part, and if they are eroded enough, you will eventually get into the coding part, and then you have a disaster. So that's really one. It's both they're protective from sticking, and that they protect the inner part. Yeah?
What's the significance of DNA A's from these on a string? I assume that's true.
The significance of DNA's from what?
Separating DNA and protein in the DNA.
Okay. The question is, what do you need the DNA's for here at all? Looking at chromatin, you cannot tell tight chromatin from loose chromatin. So how are you going to tell what's exposed, what's sticking out, and what's not? So the idea is you add an enzyme from the outside of chromatin. So, for example, the DNA can get into here, but it can't get into here. So it allows you to find out, in fact, that there's a sort of stretched out linker part and a tightly protected part. Now, this, the other DNAs that I wrote here distinguishes at a different level, and is, we'll describe how you use it next. Any other? Yeah?
Is there a correlation between introns and heterochromatin?
This has nothing to do with introns.
So heterochromatin.
In interphase, both introns and exons, remember, are equally transcribed. So they're going to be in an equal state of euchromatin because they're all transcribed. What may be different is the untranscribed from the transcribed, but introns and exons are both transcribed. Okay, so now we want to get at this question. In an interphase cell, most of the chromatin is euchromatin, but only some of it is transcribed. We would like to find out if the transcribed genes are in looser euchromatin, and the untranscribed genes are in tighter euchromatin. And the question is, how are we going to figure that out? Now, we've explained that from looking, you can't tell. So what would you like to do? Suppose you're interested, say, in the globin genes. These are the genes that code for the protein part of hemoglobin and related proteins. So we know that they're on in certain cells that make hemoglobin, and they're off in other cells, transcribed in one, not in the other. So what you would like to do is fish the globin genes out of a cell in which those genes are being transcribed, and then you would like to fish those genes out of a cell in which they're not transcribed, and then you would like to compare the two chromatin samples. Is this chromatin tighter or looser? Is this chromatin? Well, it turns out that's virtually impossible. You have to do it backwards. What you have to do is take the chromatin and basically divide it into tight and loose. And then you have to ask, where are my globin genes? Are they in the tight part or are they in the loose part? So you have to figure out the state of the chromatin first and then locate your genes instead of getting your genes and checking the state of the chromatin. And the way you do it involves DNAs, but a different one. We already mentioned this other DNAs. The one that's used for this purpose is called DNase 1. Now, it was discovered experimentally that micrococcal nuclease will degrade linkers, but it won't degrade core DNA associated with cores. It was discovered experimentally that DNase 1 degrades DNA if the nucleosomes are fairly loose, but if the nucleosomes are very tight, it will not. So it's not distinguishing between nucleosomes, no nucleosomes. It's distinguishing between the sort of 3D packing of the nucleosomes. Is it on the loose side of the thing that I just erased? Are the nucleosomes relatively loose, or are the nucleosomes relatively tight in the heterochromin-like state? So this enzyme has been used a lot to figure out the state of chromatin. And let me say that heterochromatin is extremely resistant to degradation. The DNA in heterochromatin is extremely resistant to degradation by DNase. But what about euchromatin? The DNA in there is more sensitive, but not all of it is the same. So the basic idea is you take cells and you treat their chromatin with DNase 1. And this experiment is actually outlined on 8C. Now, the picture on the bottom is from Becker, and it explains all, it shows how this experiment was done. But it's a little compacted. So we're going to sort of take it apart. But the numbers on the right-hand top refer to the numbers of the steps in the figure below. So step one is you take euchromatin and you treat it with DNase 1. Now remember, you're not treating DNA. You're treating chromatin. So some areas of the chromatin are relatively tight, and some areas of euchromatin are relatively loose. Now, what's the point here? We assume that if we hit the relatively loose areas, what's going to happen to the DNA inside? It's going to get degraded. What's going to happen to the DNA that's inside relatively tight areas? It's going to be protected. Nothing's going to happen to it. So that's the point of step one. But now what you do, and I've divided two into two steps. The first thing you do is remove the protein. And I've left a blank here. So you're now just going to have DNA. So what's the DNA going to look like? In this case, the DNA is going to be long and undegraded. But in this case, the DNA is going to be short and chewed up. Now, how are we going to figure that out? You would think you just look at the DNA and see, is it chewed up, is it not? How do you know what state the DNA is in? DNA is so long that you can't just look at it first. What you have to do is cut it up with restriction enzymes and look at the pieces. And that's why the restriction enzyme is here. Because if we were to take plain old DNA and cut it up with restriction enzymes, what would we get? Plain old DNA. You get pieces of fixed size. Because restriction enzymes are sequence specific. DNase 1 is shape-specific. So if you use a restriction enzyme, if your DNA was protected, you're going to get discrete pieces. But if you had degraded your DNA, and now you hit it with a restriction enzyme, what are you going to get? Well, nothing. You're not going to have any discrete pieces because there was nothing there for the restriction enzyme to cut into pieces. It was all degraded already. So, now how are you going to find out whether you have discrete pieces or not? Think back to what we said before. How do you tell what state what you got when it comes to DNA? It's the same as this. You're going to run a gel. So that's what they do next. You do a gel and you block. And that's 3A. I've divided 2 into 2 steps and 3 into 2 steps. So what are you going to have? If we have DNA and nothing has happened to it except we've cut it up with restriction enzymes, then we're going to have a bunch of bands on the gel. But of course, we can't see anything yet. They're there, but you can't see them. Unless you stain for total DNA. But what if you had degraded your DNA? Then there'd be no discrete bands on the gel at all. If you were to stain for just DNA, this would have discrete bands. And this one would have nothing or just a smear. But now how do you find the globin genes? Because the whole point of doing this is to find out, are the globin genes in here or are the globin genes in here? You need a probe. So what you're going to do now is you would have a gel. This would be from, no DNase treatment. And this would be DNase treatment. Now remember, this is DNase of chromatin. So we treated the chromatin with DNase. We fished out the DNA. We cut it to reasonable sized pieces and we separated. We took some chromatin. And we treated chromatin with DNA. So in the first example, I don't know if I said it right. In the first example, you have no DNA. You didn't do anything. But here you treat the chromatin with DNA first. Then you fish out the DNA. It's all in pieces. You run a gel. You get nothing. So that's what it looks like. So now you add a probe to the globin genes. Now somewhere in here is the piece with the globin genes, and your probe will stick. What will the probe stick to over here? Anything? All your globin genes have been chewed up. There's nothing here. Your probe won't stick. So this is going to be the difference. Now, if you look at the picture on the very bottom, we'll do the top one. The top case. It describes an experiment exactly like this. Except here, they're looking at 2 genes, not 1. Now, this experiment described here in the book involves 2 different types of cells and 2 different genes. There are 2 genes, one's turned on in one cell type and one's turned on in the other, but we're going to just stick to 1 case. So they're looking at erythrocytes, or the red blood cells of chickens. Unlike human red blood cells, the red blood cells of chickens have DNA and transcribe it and make hemoglobin. So this picture here is meant to represent chromatin, not DNA. And this is where the globin genes are. And the other protein they're looking at is ovalbumin. These are the ovalbumin genes. Now the idea is red blood cells are making globin. So this section of the chromatin is looped out, is pulled out, maybe to the beads on a string. But ovalbumin is only made in the oviduct. It's a protein found in eggs. And so red blood cells are not using these genes. They're not making this protein. So now you treat it with DNase. What's going to happen? Are you going to chew up the DNA in here? No, you can't get inside. Are you going to chew up the DNA in here? You bet. Okay? So that's why the next picture looks like... Now what they do is take off the protein and leave the DNA. So the DNA from here is in pieces. The DNA from here is intact. So now they take all the DNA from these cells and they run it on a gel. Now we're just going to look at the thing that says 0 and the thing that says 0.5. This sample was not treated with DNase at all. These were treated with increasing amounts of DNase. And this one was treated with a half microgram of DNase per mil. Doesn't matter. Okay. Now this says, if you didn't treat with any DNase at all, what happened to this DNA? Nothing. What happened to this DNA? Nothing. So both of them, pieces of both of them are in here, and you do restriction enzymes and you do a gel. So if I add a probe to globin, it sticks here to where the genes for globin are. If I add a probe to ovalbumin, it sticks here because that's where the genes for ovalbumin are. So this is, except in the picture, this is the ovalbumin probe and this is the globin probe. Now what if I do it again, but I treat with DNase? In this DNA, what state are the ovalbumin genes in? Did I chew them up? No, they're fine. What state are the globin genes in? They're degraded because I chewed them up. So when I cut the DNA up and run it on a gel, and now I add the probe to the ovalbumin genes, will it find ovalbumin genes? The ovalbumin genes were tight, they weren't degraded, they're just fine. So when I add a probe, it sticks. But what happened to the globin genes? I chewed them to bits. So they aren't here. So that's why there's no band here on the gel. When you add the probe to the globin genes, it has nothing to stick to. Yeah?
When you say chewed up, do you mean individual
When I say chewed up, I don't mean to individual nucleotides, but I mean to small, short pieces that are so short they run off the gel. Okay. Now, the two parts of this experiment, if you look at it, they also did oviduct cells and got the reverse result. Now, I want to say a few more words about this and then wrap it up. In your notes, it says, and I suggest that you try it, what would these gels look like if you used two different proteins? One of them is for a kind of intermediate filament found only in neurons. If you add a probe to that gene, what would you get here? And if you had, what was the other one that I picked? RNA polymerase 2. So what we're really asking is, are these genes on either in oviduct or in red blood cells? Are these genes, this gene on in oviduct or red blood cells? Now I pick these because one of these cases is off in both and one of these cases is on in both. And the question is, what would it look like? And I'm not going to do it, but you can maybe go through it and try. What I want to do now to sum it up is to go back to this picture. By using DNase 1 to assess the state of chromatin in many different genes, in many different tissues, we come back to this picture on your handout that you can divide euchromatin into loose, looser, and loosest. It's all more sensitive to DNase 1 than heterochromatin is. But we see that the DNA, the euchromatin that is not being transcribed, like ovalbumin genes and red blood cells, is relatively inactive. It's genetically inactive. It hasn't been loosened up enough to be red. It's probably at the 30 nanometer fiber stage. But what about the ovalbumin genes in oviduct? They're being read and transcribed. They are looser. They are probably unraveled down to the beads on a string stage. So these are genetically active. But people have discovered when doing this that there are some sections which are extremely sensitive to DNase 1. And which sections this is varies from cell type to cell type. These are called hypersensitive sites. These turn out to be regions which are not transcribed but are regulatory, like promoters. Now, they don't have histones, and so they are the most sensitive of all. But do they have protein? Yes. None of this is naked DNA. They have proteins, but they have transcription factors and regulatory proteins instead of histones, and they don't protect as well. So these are the loosest, the regulatory regions. The transcribed regions, and maybe this is the surprise here, transcribed regions of the DNA contain histones. They contain nucleosomes. When RNA polymerase and DNA polymerase come along, they do not wipe out all the nucleosomes, transcribe or replicate the DNA, and put them all back. They move maybe one or two at a time. But the DNA that's being used and is active is associated with nucleosomes virtually all the time. And next time, Dr. Heiklin is going to talk about, given all of this, how do you turn on a particular section of euchromatin and get it to make its associated protein?